This is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
From the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming everywhere.
Everywhere.
At 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle app.
5 o'clock refresh brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, Washington's most refreshing beer. I will take the bet, Jim. We will double it.
All right, really?
Yes, that's correct.
I thought you were going to wuss out.
Nope. Well, not at all. This
was
is
it 50?
It was 50. It is now $100. Michael Kendricks will be available to play on the first day of training camp when the Seahawks open training camp. So that'll be the end of July.
And you're not a gambler at all.
No, I don't like betting pretty much at all. But this isn't really gambling. This is.
What'd you do? Consult your Annie Duke book and
no,
during the break?
I was trying to build suspense. Oh. I was trying to carry listeners over to improve our ratings.
Oh, it's kind of a tease.
That's correct.
Don't you think at the very least you would go, if you're the Seahawks, whether it's John Schneider or the club or whatever, wouldn't you go, I'm going to look really stupid if this guy ends up in jail when camp starts, so why would I even do anything with him?
I thought you were going to say that they would maybe go to the sentencing and go, Your Honor, he's really good.
Yeah, no, I mean, seriously, really good.
Like, we've got a tough schedule, and he's really good.
Well, he is, and I agree with you. Why would they sign K.J. Wright if they think Kendricks is coming back? Because they play the same position.
You got a shortage of – there's only two guys.
Michael Kendricks is better than K.J. Wright at this point in their careers.
Yeah, but they can't both be on the field?
Based on that last game that I saw from K.J., he's not been hurt that much. Yeah, I think –
what's Kendricks, about 3 or 4 years younger?
No, just a year, right?
Oh, one year.
Yeah.
Kendricks came in 2012. KJ was drafted in 2011.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I think there's more than enough room for both of those guys.
How so?
You're allowed to play 11 guys on defense.
No, Jim. I know. No, I love the signing. And KJ, he's such a nice guy. And you know what it means in the locker room to play with Bobby Wagner. And yeah, I think it's great they did it. I was a little surprised how much they paid him. But
who, KJ?
Yeah.
Really? Because, you know, you look at, like, C.J. Mosley got $17 million, you know, and I get the age thing, but Quan Alexander got $13.5 million. I mean, K.J.'s getting, like, half of that. So I feel like they got a bargain.
You think he's going to be the K.J. that we're used to seeing?
Well, we'll see. You know, he sure was in that Dallas game.
Yeah, he was.
And, you know, I was listening to him he was interviewed on Bob Gross and Tom today, and he was talking about how, look, I'm a smart guy, I know how to manage this thing, and, you know, he was talking about his health and how to, you know, how to take care of his knee. So he obviously thinks that it's going to be okay, and, you know, and every athlete thinks that anyway, but it didn't sound like it was something that was bothering him.
KJ Wright coming back. He also showed something. Larry Stone had a really good column today, and something that I had not thought of before was that you look at KJ's experience in free agency and how that's contrasted with other players who have been Pro Bowlers from that defense. And this isn't just to sort of cast aspersions or say KJ did it, quote, the right way, because I don't feel that way. I feel that every player should act according to what they think is most important. And I don't want to presume that loyalty or the idea that they're making sure you play with one team your whole career or sacrificing to stay with the Seahawks is necessarily better than making a decision in Earl's case to try to earn more money. But it's different to see the path that KJ walked to get back to the Seahawks, because that was a negotiation that was fraught with a lot of potential questions. Seattle could have decided. And actually, KJ last night on Seattle Sports at Night even kind of said that he wasn't sure whether the Seahawks were going to be interested in him and bringing him back. He'd been so banged up last year and the problems with his knee that it was not a foregone conclusion that he was going to get the opportunity to come back.
Yeah, did he indicate, that was the question I asked, I'm sure he did answer it, but if he had gone out on the market or anything, an indication?
He talked to Bob Gross and Tom earlier today and mentioned that he did get offers from other teams. He didn't specify which teams or whatever.
Yeah.
Here was KJ talking about that.
You know, I've been around a while and I've seen some things and everything kind of has a look. You can kind of tell, you know, who's going to be there, who's not. You know, what direction the team's going to go in, and you kind of get a feel for things. And to be honest, I wasn't too optimistic about me returning because, you know, I was injured, and they let me get to free agency, and so I wasn't too hopeful.
And here he was, and this is asked on Bob Gross and Tom about why he took that quieter route.
Yeah, I just always been a believer in control what you can control. I've never been, me personally, a fan of forcing someone to do something that they don't want to do. It's your team, your whatever direction you want to take it, you could take it. One thing that I can do is prepare myself for the season, prepare this team to be successful, make sure that I know my playbook and I'm ready to go, you know, the time the season comes. So everyone has their own way. That was my route, and I could do it all over again. Even if I did get hurt, I'd probably do it the same way.
And let me make it clear. That was from Seattle Sports at Night, which is everybody should be listening to. It's a great show with C-Raj, Stacey Rost, as well as Jake Heaps that were there. What's your reaction to the path that KJ took?
Well, I think it fits his personality. That's just who he is. And, you know, and he said there's no wrong way to do it, basically, is what he said. And you know what? As soon as you sign the contract, even a guy like Antonio Brown, I stop thinking about it. And I think most players, that was always I would always be surprised when somebody would bring up money during the season, because that's for the off season. And then, you know, every once in a while, I remember one time I had a teammate that told me how much I was making, because I didn't really know. And I obviously had a contract, but I think I was off by a certain amount. And he goes, no, you're making this, because they divulge all the, you know, salaries through the NFLPA. And, you know, I never thought of that. And so once you get signed, it doesn't really matter. And, you know, you're going to sit there as a fan probably and go, wow, we sure overpaid for this guy or whatever. But, you know, for KJ, $7.5 million a year was enough. You know, he probably got some kind of an indication that it wasn't going to be 13 or 17. Otherwise, he'd have had to go. So, you know, I just think it fit his personality. And like he said, I thought he said it very well. Everybody, you know, does it their own way, and that's his way. And as you know, we talked about this yesterday, that supposedly Pete Carroll's coaching style brings about, you know, guys that, you know, act up, whether it's Bennett or Marshawn Lynch or whatever. But what about KJ? What about Bobby? You know, I mean, those are two really solid guys that, you know, and I feel like Bradley McDougal's that way. And, you know, so that was his way. I frankly would have been surprised if it went another way than the way it did. I'm just curious, you know, how much, if you're KJ Wright, you know, and I guess you can sort of compare it in a percentage way. Like, how much less would you take to not uproot and move to another place? Is it 10%? Is it 20%? And I don't know, you know, with KJ, maybe if he went out on the market, he could have got $9 million a year instead of $7.5 million, you know, but wouldn't you stay for that much? I mean, if it's a remarkable amount, and I don't know where you draw the line, but you know, for him, it would just be so much easier. Plus, the other thing is, you know, whether it's an extra million or two down the road, playing for one team, that doesn't happen very often. And for a guy to be able to finish out with, you know, with the Seahawks for his entire career, and hopefully it'll put him in the Ring of Honor. Hey, look at that. I got it right instead of Ring of Fame or whatever. So, you know, that to me is worth something. Like, how much would you pay for that? Well, you know, a couple million. You know, over 2 years, yeah, I think I would.
I think I would too, Dave. It's not like I've ever had, you know, offers elsewhere, but Seattle, you know, the great place to live and the familiarity that you have with that organization. I was just looking at KJ's salary numbers. He made 5.8 in 2017 and 7.2 last year, and so he's scheduled to make, what, $15 million over 2 years, and I think I saw where he's going to make $8 million. In 2019, so he's getting a raise. I'd be curious to see what kind of offers he got out there, because I surely thought that he was going to be moving on. And then when we saw the Kendrick signing was before the KJ Wright signing, and when I saw that, I thought, okay, well, they're moving on from KJ Wright. So that was surprising to see that he was coming back.
I thought they were separate deals. I didn't think Kendrick's return ruled out KJ Wright. I did think KJ was a question, in large part because of the uncertainty about his knee and what happened last season and what he played in five regular season games. And he played great in the playoff game, like Dave pointed out, which is a great sign. Everybody is going to be selfish. That's, I think, the nature of what makes our economy, like at large, that's what it's based on, is the idea of you're going to be selfish. Being selfish doesn't always mean money, though. Being selfish means what you want. And Davis, you were talking about how much would you give up to stay in one place? It occurred to me that the cost of any decision you make it can be measured in different ways. The decision that Earl made about going to Baltimore and taking and looking for it, when he signed, he said, yeah. And then there was an emoji of a sack of money, and then there was a celebration sign. That I think the money was important to Earl. And it's not so much because of what I want to buy with this. It was what it said about how he was valued in
the league. Sign of respect.
Right. Yeah. And that's sort of that, hey, this is how I keep track of how I'm perceived around the league. And there's, in my mind, there's nothing wrong with saying, I want to make the most money I can. That I have a limited career here, and my objective is to make the most money I can. I also don't think that there's anything wrong with deciding I want to win more than it anywhere else. And guys do that all the time. Guys make decisions to take less money to go to a championship contender. Now, I think a championship is a little bit different when you're part of the group that builds a team up from the ground and gets to a title than the veteran who comes on for a one-year minimum deal so you can take a run at it. But that doesn't make it any less satisfying for that person necessarily if they want to win. Or maybe you want to be someone who is revered in the town that you came in with, that you want to be. Because one of the costs of Earl's approach is there are people out there that will feel differently about him in Seattle now that he's there. And I think that that's true with all of the different players that you see, that the decisions you make about what you want, there's all sorts of different ways you can come up to that, but there's going to be a cost to some of it. If you decide you want to play in Seattle, the cost might be that you don't get maximum free agent value because now you're depending on what they think you're worth.
Can you imagine if KJ had put a little sack of money on his tweet? It would have been like, whoa, somebody must have hijacked his account.
Yeah, you know? Sack of money.
But and again, it's not anything against Earl, because for Earl, it's all about the, you know, that's a reward for, or an indication of, you know, the level of skill that you have. So, you know, and I'm not saying that Earl is money grubbing or anything like that, but you're right. I mean, you want to get as much as you can, and obviously the team wants to pay the least amount. So I'm not surprised that they were able to find a middle ground there. And then the other thing is, if there was no knee problem, you know, maybe KJ goes out in the market and does make $11-12 million
a year. Look at the money some of those linebackers. CJ Mosley got $17.5 million.
I can't believe that.
That's a lot of money.
And for an inside backer, too, because usually, you know, the outside get guys that can rush. You know, and I know they sent him quite a bit. You know, he's a decent pass rusher, but I don't think he's as good as Bobby. But, yeah, he got that. Quan Alexander, who I really like. He's exciting. He's a player I'll tune in to watch. But he got $13.5 million. There's no way he's twice as good as KJ. Dollar-wise. So, yeah, I mean, it was if KJ was, and this is why I say, like, the timing of, you know, certain years and your age and everything can really, it's almost like luck. Like, some of these players, the amount of money that they've gotten, is that team has not gotten the value out of them. Like, who was it that signed? Was it Malik Jackson a couple of years ago?
Yes, Jacksonville.
He's a great player, but I don't think he's what that contract was, because I think it was like $17 or $18 million a year, and that was 2 years ago.
And he got let go, and now he's with Philadelphia, and his acquisition in Philadelphia was one of the reasons that Michael Bennett ended up moving on. The other person that's selfish in this equation, and this is worth noting, fans are selfish. Fans are selfish, and there's nothing wrong with them being selfish of, I want what I want for my team. I want the players I like to stay with my team. And sometimes you'll be mad at the team that they don't keep your favorite player. Or sometimes you'll be mad at the player because they don't stay with your favorite team. And everybody on all sides, teams are selfish. Sometimes teams do things because of they want to keep a certain player. But most of the time, they're making decisions based on what's in the best interest of the franchise. It's not to make everybody happy. And you hear them talk about it's a business. So I've always thought that there's no judgment, and you shouldn't fault someone for acting in their own self-interest, because if you don't look out for yourself and what you want, no one else is going to do it for you. But it is interesting when you see the path that different players chose. And I'm happy for KJ that it worked out. And I do think it worked out, because he got himself a contract that I completely didn't know if that was going to be in the cards for him from the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah, and the money's just guaranteed for the first year, so we'll see. And just a 2-year deal, so and KJ turning 30 in July, it has a good chance of working out. Danny, as you mentioned, 5 games that he played in 2018. That knee could end up being problematic, but before that, he'd only missed 3 games in the 7 previous seasons. So there's a good chance, 50-50 anyway, that it's going to work out, and it's not a huge contract. But in light of what you said about being critical of someone looking out for their own self-interest, I just appreciate how KJ handled his business as opposed to the way Earl did his. And I say that just because I don't think I'm alone here. I mean, he did sign a contract. The Seahawks, he did make $10 million this last year, and I just didn't like the way he handled that at all. You signed the contract, you're getting paid for that season, and the way he acted was not cool.
This is an interesting question because we've seen a number of guys that have moved on from the team. Marshawn Lynch, who he retired but then came out of retirement to play for someone else. Richard Sherman was released. It wasn't his choice to leave Seattle. He was released but then chose to go to San Francisco and said in part that was because he was kind of a vengeful person. He wanted to take it out on the team that released him. We've also seen Michael Bennett be traded and now Earl Thomas leave as a free agent. I would say that those are 4 of the – and Golden Tate you can throw in too because Golden Tate was a huge part of the Super Bowl team. But I don't think – of all those guys, I think Golden Tate, people understood his decision most in that he had a better financial opportunity elsewhere and the Seahawks had decided to pay Percy Harvin significantly more than they were offering him. But I'd be interested to hear how people feel about those different players. I know that everything ultimately is going to be forgiven with all of those guys, I think. But
people will always side with the franchise.
At the end of it, absolutely.
And really what you're doing is you're siding with the billionaires over the millionaires. And look, these guys are getting a lot of money. But I always think that like the perspective comes from either a guy played football in high school or whatever, or somebody's married to a guy that played football. And you're like, you can understand like Paul Allen, the late Paul Allen being worth, you know, billions of dollars because of everything that he did. But sometimes I think it's hard for you to wrap your mind around that this guy's out there playing a game, you know, that I used to play or my husband used to play, and he's making $20 million a year. I think people, I'm not saying that's fair and it may not be right, but they're always going to side with the team on that one because I don't know. I feel like there's just like, come on, really? Can you believe how much these guys are making? Nobody complains about, you know, the owners and how much money they're making out of this whole thing. And so I think they're a little bit more identifiable. And, you know, you kind of look at it and go, man, ultimately, this guy is just playing a game.
Yeah, out of all these, I was just sitting here thinking about all the stars. And Danny, you're right. In years to come, they're all going to be embraced. Sherman, Michael Bennett, when he comes back, all these different guys. But I think in the end, for me, like 5 years from now, when they all come back and have their get together and have an anniversary celebration of their Super Bowl championship, I think I'll appreciate KJ Wright the most. And probably second most, it'll be Cam Chancellor, just because how these two guys went about their business. And I say Chancellor second because of the holdout that he had. And again, you know, looking out for himself, I guess I understand that. But
he came back, though.
He did come back. And I have a hard time getting down on Chancellor for anything because I just think he's a class act. But certainly KJ Wright and the other guys, yeah, I mean, I think all will be forgiven in time. But, boy, the way they left town, it just...
Who are you the most bitter at? Because for me, the answer is easy, and I'm not sure. It's
I'm not really bitter at any of them. I just sometimes, you know, when I look at them, I'm going, man, you guys turned into, you know, pieces of work at some point.
Well,
I'm not sure why, because, you know, Michael Bennett was a cool guy to deal with. Richard Sherman was cool to deal with until they weren't. You know, I mean, it just all of a sudden turned. And then
you kind of went
back to, oh, man, you know, money sure spoiled those guys. That's kind of what I come back to.
Come up with your power rankings, though, of which one was the biggest piece of work. Because for me, it was Sherman, and I'm not sure why, because he was pretty well behaved.
I thought Michael Bennett was a bigger jerk than Sherman.
See, I think Bennett's the lowest of the guys that left.
Yeah, Michael Bennett was, he took the cake for me.
Because he yelled at reporters?
I just didn't like him. Yeah. Do I need a reason?
No, well, you have the best reason.
Yeah, I just...
I, I'd say I have the second best reason, because I was sitting ringside. Once he did that to you, I was just like, oh, man, I'm done with this guy.
When you look at those guys, because in some ways, Earl's the one that made the choice to leave. Out of all those players, it would be Earl number one and then Marshawn number two. Yet I find myself that Earl and Marshawn, I kind of see them as their actions as being kind of consistent with who they were. And it doesn't change how I feel about them in the same way that I do feel differently about Richard Sherman than I did 4 years ago.
Okay, so speaking of ranking, how high is not getting on the bus to go to the playoff
game? Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of Marshawn either. The way he worked things, you know, I mean, it's like, God, be a part of the team. And I know that's an old school way of thinking, but he wasn't really a part of the team.
Yeah, remember the time he stayed out in halftime, out on the bench?
Well, it was cold out there. He was sacrificing himself. He needed to ice his back.
He put himself above the team.
Never heard of that before.
It's Danny David Moore. This actually could be kind of a fun conversation. If you're going to come up with a power ranking, whose departure left you fuming most of these Seahawks players? We'll talk about that next.
From the Alaska Airlines Studio,
it's Danny, Dave, and Moore, streaming everywhere at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle app.
5 o'clock refresh brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, Washington's most refreshing beer. This isn't the most positive subject, but I actually think it's interesting. Of the Seahawks who've left from this Super Bowl championship era, which guy stuck in your craw the most? Like, which one do you have the sort of the biggest objection to? The 509 texted in, it's the bad apple syndrome. Sherm started rotting. It spread to Bennett. Then Earl went to cider. I don't know if that's how cider's actually made, but I thought that was good. From the 206, Sherman, he forgot how good he had it. From the 253, Earl number one, the whole Cowboy locker room refusing to practice in the middle finger. The Hawks paid him his full contract. And he said, how many players do that in their final act with the team? So you have different people who react very, very differently. And, Dave, I'd forgot about Marshawn in the bus. And that's something that probably can't be changed. That was him taking all the practice reps that week before the Minnesota game in a year that he'd come back from an abdominal surgery and provided no indication that there was any uncertainty about him playing. And then deciding that he couldn't go.
Yeah, and those practice reps are highly cherished by the backups. I mean, yeah, that might be the worst thing. And I loved Marshawn. You know who just loved Marshawn was my mom. And I think yours too, probably, because he came over and gave her a hug.
Yes.
And, yeah, and I think she bought some kind of beast mode thing or something off the internet and just loved the way he played. And he was very old school, but yeah, that one's pretty bad because, look, yeah, like I said, you're taking all the reps that week. And, you know, reps are precious. To me, they were, anyway. They end up winning that game, and then they came back, and, you know, he was on the bus the next week. But just the way he handled it. And the story was that Pete didn't know. Somebody had to come and tell Pete Carroll on the buses on the way to the airport, Marshawn is not on the bus. And did not make the trip. So that's pretty bad. I mean, that's up there with, we always rip Percy Harvin for not going into the game. And that was a third, fourth game during the regular season. But for a playoff game to do that, that was pretty bad. I don't have the ill feelings towards Marshawn. I guess if I rank it, I would have to go with Bennett first and foremost, just because. Nah, I can't do that. It's got to be Sherm. I mean, saying all the things that he said about Pete, that's the worst thing. And Bennett never did that. He was protective of Russell, too. And so, you know, just the outburst that Bennett had with you. And the thing that bothered me, I guess, with Sherm was always kind of contentious, but Bennett was pretty happy when he first got here. He was a happy guy and laughing and joking. He's really funny. And I love talking to him. And then all of a sudden, it's like, what are you so mad about? Yeah, it was just weird how that went down. But I think Sherm saying stuff about Pete Carroll, that's where it really crossed the line and made him probably the one that sticks in your craw the most.
For you, who is it? It's Bennett?
Well, yeah, I was just sitting here thinking, you know, especially when John Schneider and Pete Carroll were the ones that gave them this opportunity to be the stars that they became. And you know, whether, you know, Sherman wanted to say, well, fifth round and, yeah, I made myself be the player that I became. You know, you could say that too, but yeah, it was just, I don't know. That's the thing where you wonder, and Dave, you've talked about it too, like you don't really think Frank Clark or another athlete's going to turn into the next Michael Bennett or Richard Sherman that way.
You hope
but
not.
You hope not, but you don't know because it happens all the time in sports, and we see it all the time, and you hope it doesn't. But, you know, I worry about that with Frank Clark a little bit. But, you know, I don't want to rate them per se, you know, which guys I dislike the most, because I'm just an optimistic and sunny person most of the time, and I don't like criticizing others. That's basically my cop-out for that. You know, I will
says
say,
the guy that now has $100 on a guy going to prison.
He's just going to
lie.
Oh,
yeah, that's just
he's
a business decision.
I'm
oh,
not
that's
sure
a business
if you say,
decision.
Is it a bald-faced lie
honestly,
or a bald-faced
honestly,
lie?
Honestly, the guy that I really had no use for at the end, more than anyone else, was probably Marshawn Lynch. And I just don't like it when an athlete gets in a position where he feels like he's bigger than the team, and then not only knows that he's bigger than the team, that he takes advantage of that. If you had, I would love to go over to Dino's Pub with Pete Carroll sometime and just sit there and go, Pete, just tell me everything there is to know about Marshawn that we didn't know. We'd be there all night. The things that he probably did to make it work for Marshawn Lynch, and then it was just kind of like, it didn't seem appreciated to me.
I'm going to channel a Jim Moore here, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, because I know everything you're saying is right, but I just don't feel that way. I completely disagree. I love Marshawn. And given all of the different things of not getting on the bus, and I don't know why I feel the way I do, but I just feel I really like Marshawn. Like,
That sounds like me talking.
Yes. It's because he took a picture with my mom. It's because I felt that he made it in the NFL on his own terms, that the same things that made him such a fun player to watch, and I loved watching Marshawn Lynch play football, the way he runs. I still love the way he runs. All of those things, that adamant refusal to be told no, that's probably part of the reason he could be so difficult to manage and he was so anti-authority. But I just embrace it. I love the very essence of him as a football player, even though that runs counter to any idea of what it means to be a good employee. I know it doesn't make any sense what I'm saying, but that's the way I feel.
That does sound like Jim. I can't tell you
I don't
why.
Know why
I'm surprised. Danny, are you surprised?
I'm surprised. I'm not more mad about him not getting on the bus, but I'm not, because I just loved how rigorously he was so steadfastly independent and headstrong that I really respected it.
Yeah. Well, and somebody else talking about, and I said something about taking shots at Pete on the way out. I guess Bennett did that too, right?
He did a little bit. It was a little.
Said he was reading during the meeting.
Yes, he told Greg Bishop from Sports Illustrated that.
I don't think that was happening.
No.
And Pete said it wasn't happening.
The other thing is he's just doing that to kind of show off, right? Like, I'm so familiar with everything that this is what was happening. Sherm's the one that sticks in my craw. I think it's not just the list of transgressions, because I actually think he was pretty well behaved. He wasn't defiant in his final season with the Seahawks. That was the end of his second to last season, and he got cut. It wasn't his choice. I think it's because Sherm always thinks he knows best, and he just will not.
He'll never admit that he's wrong.
He'll never vacate that spot. And to me, that being around that, and I really liked Sherm and thought he was really, really funny. And I would say that I still have a sense of like, okay, I understand who Sherman is. But that idea of when you leave and you're, I know best, there's a part of me very much that wants to see that kind of person brought down a peg. And that's probably why I'm going to continue to root for Russell Wilson to throw 5 touchdown passes on him when they play the 49ers in the first game next year. And if it doesn't happen then, I'll be rooting for the exact same thing when they play again, because I want to see him brought down a peg. And I don't feel that way about Earl Thomas, and not even really about Michael Bennett. Although watching Michael Bennett give up big runs because he goes charging upfield, there is a little bit of satisfaction in that, of like, yeah, man, you focus on all the sacks and you leave your defense a little bit, you leave your backside exposed and you got throttled there.
You know what I'm not buying with Sherman? How many games did he play for the 49ers this year? Was he out there the whole time?
12? He missed a
12?
Couple. Yeah.
Well, okay, when we talked to Clayton, and I love the professor, but, you know, I think John talks about, you know, they didn't throw in his direction very often. He had a really good season. They didn't throw it. They threw it the other side and all that. I'm thinking, I don't know if I'd necessarily buy that. I don't think Richard Sherman is half the player that he once was.
He played 14 games. He didn't have any interceptions. They didn't throw at him. Now, some of that was because there were plenty of opportunities for him to throw. To throw to other people.
Well, maybe I wasn't paying attention. Maybe he's still, you know, a semblance of what he once was.
You don't think he guards opposing receivers as well?
I don't think so. Or it might be that I'm just hoping that's the case.
What kind of yardage were they in? Was it yardage one or yardage two or yardage three?
Sure. Maybe they were showing a little bit of yardage three.
I want to say he said guard one time.
Did he?
Yeah, and I wanted to say something to him, and I didn't. But, yeah, Sherm's the one that probably – you're right. He's kind of a know-it-all.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, being a fellow Stanford guy, I felt like most of the guys – well, everybody that I pretty much knew at Stanford was always – like my wife would always say how – you know, whenever she would meet those kinds of, you know, like at the alumni meetings and stuff like that, that they would ask her lots of questions and just nobody was a know-it-all, in other words. And then out comes Sherm, and he's kind of a know-it-all. And I feel like it gives Stanford a bad name.
Well, he was a funny know-it-all at
he
first.
Was. He was. Yeah, hilarious.
In the beginning, yeah, because like he had the UMad bro and all that stuff.
People.
And I loved that. And I think that the fans really identified with that. They wanted to be put on the map. They wanted people to – they wanted somebody to talk trash and back it up. And Sherm did. If you go back and look, I think he has 25 interceptions career. No, he doesn't. It's 32. And if you look at some of the interceptions that he had in the moments, the tip play, I mean, just unbelievable player, especially considering watching him in college. He was the most oft complained about player that I've ever seen play at Stanford University. I remember just, what is Sherm doing?
How good do you think he would have been with another team?
It's a good question. You know, he is really smart. He's a really smart football player. There was a preseason game a few years ago where he was talking about, as they were doing the broadcast, and he's calling out the formation and talking about what they're trying to do and everything. I mean, you can see that he's, like, fluent in football. And so for that reason, I think he would have done really well. But, you know, we've seen what's happened to corners that have left here. If he has success down in San Francisco, he'll be the first one that left this defense and was as successful as he was here.
The other thing I'll say is that there's no doubt in my mind that he would have ran into trouble with another coach way sooner, because if we think Marshawn Lynch was a headache, we saw some of the headache. Marshawn, publicly, you never really saw anything up until him not getting on the bus. Sherm, you saw a bunch of stuff, and I bet that was just the tip of the iceberg. It is Danny David Moore. We're going to get back to who the Seahawks added specifically. What does this offensive line look like going forward? That's next.
This is Danny Dave and Moore.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
It is Danny Dave and Moore. And Seahawks free agency, I would say this. They lost 6 free agents. Not as severe as it could have been, because the two biggest ones they lost were guys you thought they were going to lose. When free agency began, I fully expected Earl Thomas to be gone, and Justin Coleman, I thought, was probably going to get a richer contract. Once we saw the Tavon Young offer and what he re-signed for in Baltimore, I thought that he was probably going to be moving on. On the offensive line, Seattle loses J.R. Sweezy, which is a huge bummer, but they add Mike Iupati, and they re-sign D.J. Fluker to a 2-year contract, somewhere between $6 and $9 million Fluker will make. With some protections, if it's only $1 million that's fully guaranteed if he's unable to play. I think Seattle's offensive line is in good shape. There's still a big part of me that worries, though, with J.R. Sweezy moving on, and you've got two veterans in Fluker and Iupati, both of whom have had an injury history, and then you've got Jordan Simmons, who's coming off of a knee injury, you've got Ethan Posick, but then you got to throw in George Fant into this conversation. And that's someone Seattle has some high expectations for this season, because the level they're going to pay him about $3 million. That's what they're on the hook for him. He might be more than a third tackle for them this year.
What a great story he is. I just love George. The National Phantom. Isn't that what our guys called
him? That's correct, yes. Stand for the National Phantom.
And when he caught that ball and stumbled, that was so funny, man.
Or you could call him the Phantom Menace.
Yeah. Anyway, am I going to go Tom Sula here on you?
Yeah.
That happened yesterday, Jim. You missed it, but he started making jokes, and I didn't even realize I did it. Luckily, Jessamine, who has the hardest job in the world, she actually listens to our show. Caught me with a after one of his little.
It was
puns.
Pretty obvious.
So it was pretty similar to Tom Sula.
Yeah, it was. I just was looking this stat up on Mike Iupati and him and Solari. So from 2010 to 2014 is when those two guys were there together. They had a top five. They had a top five running game. When they left, they both left for the 2015 season. So where did Solari go?
Solari went for 2015.
Oh, he went to New York. He went to New York to coach the Giants. And Yopati left and went to Arizona that year. It dropped in 2015 to number 21. So they're top five for 5 years there with those two guys together. And then Arizona in 2014, they were the number 31 rushing team. And when Yopati gets there in 2015, they go to number nine. So, you know, look, maybe this is a coincidence, but those two guys working together, and you can understand why Solari would probably say, hey, man, I love J.R. Sweezy. But I know this guy, this Yopati guy. He's a couple years older. He was a Pro Bowler for 4 years. He was all pro in 2012, which is, you know, voted on more carefully than the Pro Bowl. And it's just one guy. I mean, you're the left guard on the all pro team. So you can understand a little bit more clearly why they let J.R. Sweezy go. Because, you know, you talk to Mike Solari, he's had Fluker, he saw the energy he brought there. And then, you know, it's also a couple million dollars cheaper per year. So, you know, the deal for Sweezy was hard to swallow. And I didn't like it either. But when you start to look at it and look at how big Yopati is, I think they're going to for sure have the biggest offensive line in the NFL.
I'll say this too.
He's like 330.
Yeah. Solari gets some credit because of how DJ Fluker worked out. Right?
Absolutely.
That DJ Fluker was a guy he worked with the Giants, and Fluker had been on the market the year before. He'd went from San Diego, where he was a first-round pick, to the Giants, and Seattle wasn't really all that interested in him. They obviously brought him in because Solari said, hey, this is a guy that we can work with, and it worked out. He was a really good addition.
Yeah, it's. I was just thinking about when you're talking about George Fant, with paying him $3 million, that's twice as much as you paid Fluker and Sweezy last year, because they were only making $1.5 million. So I'm in that camp that thinks that George Fant, they're expecting more from him this year. They're not going to just use him in that jumbo package, and that he might push Ifedi for the starting right tackle job.
Would you move Ifedi inside?
No, I would have juggled it around if you hadn't signed Yopati, but I don't know. I like the idea of having more competition there, and maybe we'll see that in training camp with Fant and Ifedi.
What do you think the future holds for Ifedi?
Yeah, it's a good question. I feel a little bit safer with him at guard, actually, than on the edge. I think George Fant is more athletic than he is. So, but yeah, and he's a huge dude, but he played well last year, you know, and it started out rough for him. Now, he did face Von Miller and Khalil Mack, and that was tough. But after that, you know, that the offensive line really played well once those two games were gone, and, you know, he just looked like a different player to me. And so hopefully he will continue. And I think honestly, and I love Tom Cable. I really do. And I agree with a lot of the things that he was teaching and said and everything, but I just feel like Solari was a better fit for him anyway. And the thing that always bothered me was the deal when Tom Cable said, we want to make you uncomfortable, Jermaine Ifedi. That did not make any sense to me. Like, Jermaine Ifedi, you want to make him comfortable. Try to make it simple for him. And maybe there's something Solari talked about. You know, Gary Gilliam used to be really good at expressing how coaches, you know, communicate with him and how they were coaching him. Remember, he was talking about trust yourself, that you're going to get to that point quicker. I mean, those are the little things that get said that give a player confidence. And I think Mike Solari has that. And maybe it just didn't click with Tom Cable. Tom Cable's a great coach, but, you know, they're, for whatever reason, Solari, and, you know, it's just kind of interesting looking at those stats of him and Yopati and what he's done to running games wherever he goes. I know the running game was bad in New York, but if you'd had Saquon Barkley blocking behind those offensive lines, I think he would have got something, because, you know, they're online. You can see all this stuff about you. Because remember last year when they signed Solari and Fluker, they're like, what are they doing in Seattle? Because the Giants couldn't run the ball. If you go look at some of the highlights, I'm like, what the hell is the running back doing, man? I mean, he's just sitting behind a double team. You know, there was some places to run. And, you know, whenever you look at the blocking scheme only and don't pay attention where the running back is, it can look bad. So it's worked out really well. And again, I think the longer I go and the more I start to look at these kinds of things, the more it makes sense. As much as it hurts that J.R. Sweezy is gone, that they made the right move.
It's Danny, Dave, and Moore. We got the professor, John Clayton, to wrap up a busy week in free agency. And then we're going to talk to the Seahawks' new kicker, Jason Myers, all ahead on Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Wow, you sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's time to find out what we learned, brought to you by Carter Volkswagen. Jess!
Guys!
It's been a busy week.
What a week it was.
It feels like news is actually happening again.
I know.
Stuff,
love it.
Stuff happened.
You know what we haven't talked about in a long time is the draft. Because we're Kyler Murray and all that stuff, but with all this stuff going on.
I know.
It's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, free agency started Wednesday, officially at 1 p.m. Pacific time, but news started happening on Monday. So, yeah, we were pretty golden. So we're going to have a special free agency edition of What We Learned Today. It will not be based on the show, but it will be based on what has happened. And we'll start with DJ Fluker, who the Seahawks did sign to a 2-year deal, I believe, 6.5 a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Healthy raise.
Yeah. Good for him.
Yeah.
He deserves it. And so we learned that, you know, DJ Fluker can be one of the best sound bites.
Yeah, they kept on all game. We battled now. It was like two bears in the woods going at it, you know. But, hey, we came out on top of it, so, hey, I'm happy with that.
Two bears in the woods going at it.
He is a big old bear, isn't he?
Yeah, don't come into the woods unless you're ready for a bear fight.
I love that.
He is, I think the lesson you learn there is that if you really love football and show a lot of passion about it, that it counts for something. So, and it's not like J.R. Sweezy didn't have that, but you know, that's just, if you're gonna pick between the two, I don't know, did you guys my choice was Fluker.
See,
if
my choice was Sweezy.
Yeah, I wanted Sweezy too.
Mine was Fluker. We're 50-50.
Yeah.
Which, here's the one thing, is that Fluker's deal is much more friendly to the Seahawks. It's 2 years, and it's, as Jess said, probably about $6.5 million, but there's only $1 million of that that's guaranteed. So if he does completely break down, he's not able to play, they're not out a lot of money.
Right. He's only guaranteed $1 million in that 2-year deal?
Yes. But if he makes the team, he's going to get a significant chunk of it.
We don't know what Sweezy got yet?
2 years, $11 million. $5.5 million per year.
Okay.
And he probably got more of that guaranteed.
Do you feel like Yapati's an upgrade over Sweezy? If he's healthy?
I don't know. If he's healthy, yes. I think that's a big if. He hasn't been healthy the past 2 years.
I just want to play one more bite from DJ Fluker, because I love him so much.
Fair.
Let me just say, they need a mauler, a guy that's going to get it done. 4th and 1, the guy they want to run behind is DJ Fluker. And I was just like, you know what? Well, I could be that guy for you. So your thing about it was just having a mindset mentality. And on top of that, they won a Super Bowl, too. So it was like, you know, we just need a few pieces here and there to make this team go back to how it was. And I was like, I don't mind being a part of that.
That was DJ right after, in his first interview after signing with the Seahawks last year.
Was he still wearing the couch? Because he signed that contract wearing something that looked like out of Dracula's lounge.
He shot a couch.
Yeah.
Made a jacket out of it.
I'd take DJ in that fight. DJ versus the couch. He doesn't need a shotgun.
Is he the best guard on the team now?
Yeah. Trying to
probably
think.
And it's pretty cool
too, because it's really close, him or Russell, who's got the best quotable most quotable material.
Well, and he's overcome a speech impediment too.
Yes.
And you don't even know, I don't notice that. If you didn't know that about him, you wouldn't think anything of it.
I think it takes a lot of courage for someone who has had a speech impediment to speak and to do interviews, especially when it's not necessarily expected or asked. You don't have to do that. I love DJ Fluker. I love his personality. You remember when he talked to us about choke slamming the guy from Oakland?
Mm-hmm.
It was C.O. Moore. He's like, he got up there, and I'm like, you're going to have to come down. And I was like, it's okay. It's football. He'll be fine.
Yes. And here, hold on. Can we do one more? Because here it is.
You're with the Chargers.
Yeah.
It can only be described as a choke slam. A guy was coming, and you lifted him up, and then you planted him down.
Oh, yeah. C.O. Moore. I'll never forget that game.
It's the Raiders linebacker, right?
Yeah.
What happened?
He pissed me off. He kept bull rushing me. I was like, man, I said, this is the only move you got. Like, literally, I was like, you know, and at the time I was playing with Jerry McClary, Nick Harwick. I had a left guard, Ryan Earnhardt, that's his name, and King Dunlap. So it was kind of like our starting five. You know, they're all older guys, so it was like, all right, here we go. Going to Oakland, my first time playing away, you know. He was good, though. He didn't do too much, but he was okay, you know. But he pitched me off, so we had a slide. I think it was a 3-3 jet. We were slide to me. And he sped up field. He went to speed the ball. I'll never forget speed the ball. I got underneath him. I caught him. And then as he was trying to go inside to hit field, he threw a dagger to Malcolm Floyd, I believe. But during the play, I didn't really see it, but I seen it on film the next day. But he hit him going inside. Claire with my guard, I slammed into him. He picked him up. The only thing I saw was his eyes. I said, oh, yeah, he's over. Come on down. That's all right. Remember, I was like, hey, go on. I said, yeah, he getting up. He done.
He's done.
Well, after that, I think he said something about...
he was spitting up blood.
He was spitting up blood, and his reaction was, he'll be okay. He'll be all right.
It's football.
Yeah.
Yeah, how could you not want that guy on this team? No offense to Sweezy. He's just only, it's 1A and 1B. Now, you mentioned guys that have been re-signed, but the final thing we'll learn today is about one of the guys that has departed. Though he's somewhere else, Earl remains the most interesting safety.
Earl Thomas is kind of like the Dos Equis guy.
He's so fast that he makes radar guns guess. So talented that even opposing quarterbacks list him as their favorite receiver. He's so faithful to the game that it has been declared his lawfully wedded wife.
No, you know, I'm married to football, so when you're married to a person, you take your vows and you treat it right. It's a privilege to be out here. And I'm not going to follow the trends of the crowd. That's not me. That's not my style. Well, 2-9 is right here. I'm pushing that thing, you know?
He is the most interesting safety in the world.
Those were the good old days, weren't they, with Earl?
I still feel like they're the good old days. I don't feel that Earl's different. I don't have a bad taste in my mouth about him. I know some people do. I really don't.
How did his press conference go today in Baltimore?
It was
did
fine.
Say all the right things.
Yeah, he didn't come off as bitter. I didn't think.
You guys see Marlon Humphrey?
No.
Number 29 in Baltimore.
What did he say?
He yesterday, he quote tweeted Earl and said, hey, awesome, what number are you wearing next year? Completely kidding. He's a really funny guy. And then today he tweeted out that he's like, at first I was going to ask for money. And then I was like, no, I haven't done anything in this number. And Earl can have it. He's a legend. He's done a lot in 2-9, so he can have it, which was really respectful. And his teammates just started dogging on him. Oh, you're green. You got a, I think Buda Baker was like, you got to Uncle Sam him for that. It was really funny. And, you know, Earl kind of put out a pretty blunt statement that said, Marlon and I worked it out. I'm going to wear number 29. Marlon's like, yeah, man, I'm not even charging him for it. And his teammates just dogging him for it. It was really funny, but all is good in Baltimore.
I think Earl's going to play really well into his mid-30s. I don't see him slowing down. And I wish him all the best. I'd like to see it. He just wasn't going to do it here, though. It just wasn't going to happen. So they moved on from him. But, man, how he came back after that broken leg, I thought he looked as good as ever. And I think he can continue to do that into his mid-30s.
Yeah, I can't believe those Will Blackman rumors didn't come true, Danny. I left here that day thinking, man, Earl Thomas is going to remain with the Seahawks. It didn't work out.
No, it didn't. It was a pipe dream that was open for about 12 hours after that and then slammed shut. I had a little tear drip down the side of my cheek as that happened.
Yeah, I'll bet.
That's going to do it for us. Want to thank Jessamine McIntyre for being our producer. This show, all shows. Curtis Rogers on the board, and for the three of us, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you Monday at 3 on Danny, Dave, and Mark.